Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Peter Whittle. Now, before I introduce my guests, we've just got one notice, or should I say two notices, actually. Our national conference is on April the 20th. It's now sold out. However, don't despair if you've left it too late. You can, you know, put forward your name and it can go onto a waiting list for returns. There are always some. So that's good. It's very good news, actually, that there's been such enthusiasm for it. Also, this coming Tuesday in Manchester, there is one of our local events. That's the Manchester Group. Going so well, all of the local groups. Please do come along if you want to. If you're in Manchester or in the surrounding area, do come along. I shall be there. It'd be great to meet you. The best thing to do is to write to locals at newcultureforum.org.uk, and then we can send you the details. Okay, now on this show, in fact on the channel, all the time we're highlighting the kind of persistence of wokery in our institutions and indeed the deconstruction of our history. What you might not be so aware of is that you end up paying for an awful lot of it. This is something that's been highlighted by the great work of the Taxpayers Alliance, which you probably know them from television and from newspapers. I'm joined today, I'm very pleased to say, by their campaigns manager, Elliot Keck. Elliot, thank you very, very much.
Great to be here, Peter.
For joining us. I want to start with one thing that's been in the news just as recently in this past week. And that is this wonderful story, which I think got you a front page, I think, which is that there has been a grant given by the government to, you can tell me, to decolonize the work of Robert Louis Stevenson, of course, who wrote Treasure Island. What's going on here? Can you just tell us what the story is?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Listen, when we talk about things like a culture war, we assume that it might at least be a bit of an even battle. But the problem is that actually on one side of the culture war, i.e. the side that want to besmirch everything good about British culture, and in this case, Scottish culture, they actually have quite a bit of taxpayer funding. And I think you sort of touched on that in your introduction. So Robert Louis Stevenson, this very beloved Scottish author, joins another, of course, beloved Scottish author who is now under attack by one very vociferous side of the debate. He wrote works Treasure Island, Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, of course, the most famous. And Treasure Island, of course, depicts the Caribbean. It's a couple of centuries old. It's not going to be entirely up to date. It's also, I think we should remember, a fantasy novel, fundamentally.
Yeah.
And it's a piece of fiction. But there's a university in Scotland that is receiving hundreds of thousands of pounds, £800,000 in total over a four-year period to decolonize his works. And I don't know exactly what that means.
No one does.
No, I think that's entirely the point. And it means that actually, you know, the UK Research and Innovation are the body that granted the money. And listen, on their website, they claim they have these very rigorous review processes that, you know, you have to make your case for the research project. I assume that means there will have to be some sort of, you know, key elements that you have to include. But when you have such a vague topic and such a vague title, it could include absolutely anything. But I assume what we'll end up getting is some sort of long report about all the racism contained in, again, this book that we have to remember that is centuries old and is fundamentally a fantasy novel.
Yes, 800,000 over 4 years.
Yeah, so £200,000 in the latest
this
year.
This is not small money.
It's not.
This is just to look at the works of one man.
Yeah.
Is it specifically just for Treasure Island, or is it all his stuff?
I believe it's just Treasure Island, because it's Treasure Island that is the focus of those colonial elements. But I mean, listen, it is a huge amount of money. And of course, listen, universities are significantly taxpayer-funded. Tuition fees are taxpayer-backed. It would be one thing if a university was using its own cash. I think that's, you know, to some extent defensible. I think universities should be free to spend their money as they see fit without government control. I think that is important.
Yeah.
I think if you have government exerting too much pressure on universities, you have problems surrounding academic freedom. This is money that's coming outside of the university budget from this Quango UK Research and Innovation, and from a particularly odious part of UK Research and Innovation known as the Arts and Humanities Research Council. Again, a perfectly, you know, nice sounding name, but an organization that gives out vast amounts of money to, I think, fundamentally counterproductive research projects.
Yes, counterproductive. They will tend to be, won't they, politically generally on one side. I mean,
yeah, almost entirely, I think.
I mean, this obviously made the news, and it seems to be like pretty much every day there's something or other.
Yeah.
But I mean, how much money of this kind is being given out?
It's obviously, it's really quite difficult to say. I mean, in that specific audit that we did for the latest financial year, we found £9 million worth of particularly bad stuff. There was another grant to an organization that was working on these sorts of breast implants for trans individuals, breast fillers of some kind. I mean, there's a whole host of really, really odd and quite disturbing grants that go towards often trying to dismantle really key parts of our culture. And Robert Louis Stevenson, of course, is a beloved author from Scotland, and I think it's really quite disturbing. But I mean, putting an exact figure on it is quite tough because there's so much of it.
Yeah, but it is quite extraordinary. I think people don't quite know that they sort of are funding it indirectly.
No,
or actually directly, in fact. You're funding. What is the sort of attitude of the TBA, the Taxpayers Alliance, to this, in the sense of what do you think should happen in a situation like that?
Well, I think there's unfortunately it's probably too late for this Conservative government, but I think some of these particularly notoriously bad and ideologically warped parts of the state, particularly the Arts and Humanities Research Council of UKRI, this broader quango, I think actually we just need to look at stripping out the funding. Listen, UKRI funds plenty of really important work in the science, medical, engineering fields, stuff that nobody would bat an eyelid at, stuff that is incredibly important that contributes to us still being, I think, a world leader in many areas of research. But then there's big parts of it that, you know, they're frankly, these projects, this Robert Louis Stevenson one would have gone in front of a board of academics themselves, probably ideologically leaning heavily in one way. And we know that from repeated studies of academics, what their political leanings are. And I think actually there's probably no solution to it other than to say, okay, you've had enough, you've had your finding approved, you can't be trusted with the taxpayer's credit card.
Right. Interesting. I remember the new president of Argentina, Mele, he made this very good point, a very simple point, but it was very well put. And he said that you were talking about the battle of ideas, you just alluded to that, you know, in a culture war, it's not a level playing field because all of these sort of ideas, or decolonization in this case, which again, very hard to actually define, but we know that it's basically undermining, you know, our cultural heritage. But he said that, in fact, all of these ideas manage to survive purely because they have public funding, right?
Yeah.
So that if you actually take away the public funding, then they might actually well survive by some other means, but at least make everyone on a level playing field.
Yeah, listen, the level playing field is absolutely crucial. And we see that right across the public sector, government funding for organizations that are actively working against government policy and against the interests of the government, a government that at some point was elected by a significant number of the population. I mean, Stonewall is the iconic example of that. Stonewall is an organization that receives millions of pounds every year from taxpayer bodies. And what do they do with that money? Well, a big chunk of that money goes towards their campaigns to lobby very, very aggressively against government policy. And so you have this bizarre lobbying merry-go-round where government tries to set policy, but the very same organizations that are campaigning against that policy receive taxpayer funding. And it's utterly bizarre situation. It's completely unsustainable. And it gives this impression that because you have these major organizations that have all of these resources that are fighting against the government, it gives the impression that actually these organizations are backed by the public. And they're not. They may be backed by taxpayers, but that's inadvertent.
Yes.
They're not backed by the public.
Yes, exactly. And also, sort of, in a way, you can't call them charities, or rather, you know, charity, you know, people tend to think of charities, you know, people juggling in front of you on the street. But these are almost de facto government bodies in a way.
They're essentially government quangos.
Exactly. Or what the other one is, it would be an NGO. Would you call these things NGOs, non-government organizations, or what?
Well, it is really interesting. There was a charity just recently on, I think it was a charity on race relations, and it was shut down actually because I think it had invited someone from the Muslim Council of Britain onto its board. Right. And the government decided to pull funding from this charity. It had taxpayer funding. Mm. And as a result of the government pulling funding from this charity, the charity immediately shut down. Mm. Now, I would argue if you're a charity and you can't exist without government funding, as you said, you're not a charity. Yes. You're a quango. Yes. You're effectively part of the state. So listen, there's a number of proposals for reform in this area. Some people have suggested that you should only be a charity if you receive a certain amount of money from grassroots, i.e. small donations.
Right.
And that actually, if you're entirely funded by one or two organizations, you don't get charity status. Mm. There's other proposals about how much taxpayer funding you can receive. That's, of course, difficult because there are charities that do important work with taxpayer funding and actually work that the state shouldn't and maybe couldn't do itself or wouldn't do as effectively. But I think certainly we do need to look at this because there are many causes that claim to be backed by seven charities. And you, let's say, and then you look at the charities that are supporting the cause and you find that they're all receiving their funding from either the taxpayer or from one or two major grant giving organizations.
Yes.
And so they get this sense of grassroots support, which just doesn't exist.
You know, with these sort of famous charities like the RSPCA and the RSPC, the one of birds.
RSPB, Royal Society for the Protection of Birds.
Are those in that category, I mean, do they get the public money?
The Royal Society, the Protection of Birds certainly does. I can't remember the top of my head if the RSPCA does. I mean, I'd say the RSPCA doesn't need it. I mean, they've received tens of millions of pounds. I mean, listen, these charities undoubtedly have a lot of grassroots support. They certainly do. They're also very wealthy organizations. And to the extent that they receive taxpayer funding, I think there should be strict limits. I remember some point last year, the RSPB wrote this incredibly hostile and aggressive tweet thread against government ministers, despite the fact that the RSPB receives a significant amount of taxpayer funding. And so, listen, I really, really think it's key that if a charity is going to receive taxpayer funding, there are strict limits on its ability to engage in essentially what is more or less party politics of another kind.
You mentioned their Stonewall, and TBA has actually done some work on Stonewall. The impression one has is that they have peaked, that their influence is sort of now going down. I think that your report or your research was a few years ago now, wasn't it?
We've done it a few times. So our latest edition was a couple of weeks ago, but are right, we've done it many different years.
And what is the general situation, Noga? So I know that they have this thing called, is it Diversity Champions, right?
Yeah, the Diversity
How does a taxpayer end up giving Stonewall money?
So it's a few different means. So I think it was about £1.5 million in the latest financial year from a range of organisations. About a big chunk of that, about a third, came from the Diversity Champions scheme. So you pay a few thousand pounds to join the scheme, and you need to prove it for a whole different range of reasons, how diverse you are and how good you are to various types of staff members that may have various issues. But unfortunately, Stonewall now focuses so much on the trans issue that it basically looks at, are you providing pronoun badges, are you providing gender neutral toilets and of that kind. So that's a big chunk of the money. Another big chunk of the money is through training programs. So Stonewall people will come in and tell you exactly what you're doing wrong. And again, this is a body that almost by its own admission is a campaign group.
Yes.
It's not a completely rigorous and impartial organization explaining how to follow the law. It's a campaign group with a very specific ideological agenda that it's within its rights to push. Everybody, it's a free country, you're entirely entitled to push your agenda. But the problem is they take millions of pounds of taxpayers' money. Yep. They go into these organizations, often quite vulnerable organizations, actually, organizations that may genuinely be nervous about how to ensure they're meeting a various piece of legislation like the Equalities Act, that are very nervous about ensuring that all their staff feel welcome and included, and genuinely actually don't know what to do. So they go to these organizations like Stonewall thinking that they're some sort of impartial arbiter that will just come in and be honest with you.
Yeah.
And you're not. You're inviting a quite ideologically extreme and increasingly ideologically extreme campaign group to come in and tell you what they want you to do, when actually it has no real basis in, of course, biological and scientific fact, but also no basis in the law itself.
So certain, say, like ministries will take Stonewall on, you know, Ministry of Defence, all that.
So that's where we've seen an improvement. That's where we've seen a big improvement. And we do have to give credit to the government, because all Whitehall departments have now removed themselves from Stonewall programmes.
Oh, wow.
The latest financial year, we did see money given by the Foreign Office through grants. but they have all now withdrawn from the Diversity Champion Scheme. The remaining organisations are quangos, universities, NHS trusts, police forces, organisations that ministers have much less direct control over, and that's a much, much broader problem in the public sector, which is ministerial control over the various elements and the various components of the public sector.
But, I mean, the other thing, you say ministerial control, you know, it appears that the civil service is not the civil service it once was, right?
Yeah.
And it's full of activists who would presumably go along with this. You know, I mean, they would think that this was exactly what we should be doing.
Yes, and listen, I've heard from civil servants that, and we've actually found out that when civil service departments have withdrawn from the Diversity Champion Scheme, there have had to be essentially crisis town hall style meetings,
really?
Inside the department, where hundreds of people will turn up to hear from one of the senior civil servants to field questions about the withdrawal from this scheme. And again, I think it's, you know, listen, there will be a part of the civil service that are very ideologically driven and very ideologically committed to some of this stuff, but actually there's also just a big part of the civil service that hears Stonewall, thinks they're the good guys, and then when you hear about and that's a lot of the problem.
Yeah.
For a lot of it, you have, it's possibly a bit of a harsh term, but you possibly just have some useful idiots in the case of
yes. What about the general DEI or DIE agenda, you know, diversity?
DEI isn't entirely,
equity, inclusion. Have you kind of looked at that? I mean, in terms of what, you know, again, isn't it the same thing as Stonewall? I mean, people come in and sort of, again, I think quite often there is, to give them the benefit of the doubt, there's a kind of naivety about the people that they're coming in, they're getting in to train. You know, quite often they are the ideological ones, but your average HR department maybe doesn't know. So, oh yeah, these people are offering it and these people, you know, what, I mean, what does the, you know, how much is the taxpayer on the hook when it comes to that stuff?
Again, difficult to give an exact figure. The latest audit that we did was of town halls, and we found that £52 million had been spent on specifically diversity staff.
£52 million?
Yeah, over the last three financial years.
Is this England and Wales?
This was the whole of the United Kingdom.
All of the United Kingdom.
£52 million in the last 3 years, a number that had doubled in the last two financial years. So this is something that is currently threatening to go off into the stratosphere, and that's just local government. It was also not all councils, only about two-thirds replied to our freedom of information request. It's an absolutely huge industry, and the problem is when you create an industry, when you create a successful industry in terms of it's achieving what it wants to achieve, it can be incredibly difficult to dismantle. The number of people who have a direct financial interest in maintaining this industry is absolutely vast. And unpicking it is going to be incredibly difficult. I know you've complained a lot about the Equalities Act, but the Equalities Act does not require any public body to have a diversity team.
Right.
It requires public bodies under the Public Sector Equalities Duty Act. It requires them to consider how its policies and its actions relate to diversity and how it will impact on different groups in society. That's true. So somebody does have to consider the policies of local government, but it doesn't need to be a separate EDI team. This can be incorporated into other teams, other HR teams, which will allow you to give a lot more holistic overall view of a policy. The problem is if you create a team that is solely looking at how a policy impacts a certain group of people, they will produce reports only looking at that.
Yes.
It's an incredibly narrow lens through which to look at a policy. It's a necessary lens, maybe, but it's not the only one. And at the moment, we have huge groups of people in most councils, most NHS trusts, most police forces that are judging policies based on an incredibly narrow set of criteria.
This is going to increase, is it not, after the next election? I mean, you know, obviously you can't put any kind of figure on it. All of this, we could add, has been happening under Conservative government.
Yes.
And you always, you know, your point is to put the government under the microscope, isn't it? But presumably with Labour, this is going to go through the roof.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm very hesitant to really criticise the Labour Party on this. I think it's a bit like the tax burden. When people say, oh, but taxes are only going to climb higher under Labour. Well, my sort of answer to that is, it feels like things can't get worse than they already are. And maybe they will. Maybe your concern is correct. But I think it's letting the Conservative government off very, very easily if we start saying it might be worse under the Labour Party. We've seen town halls under Conservative local governments double their spending on EDI staff in the last couple of years. At the same time that council after council is going cap in hand to the government, demanding more money, filing for bankruptcy, hiking their council tax, and Conservative ministers have not been brave enough to stand up and say, you're not having any more money until you deal with these huge, unnecessary teams that are sucking up vast resources.
Yes.
So, listen, it may be worse under Labour government, but given how bad things are now, I'm not inclined to let the current government off the hook.
Yeah.
You've also done quite a bit of work, haven't you? One of your campaigns, I believe, has been about the global quangos. So, I mean, we're talking, what are we talking? We're talking, what, eight, the World Health Organization?
United Nations, World Health Organization, and this International Monetary Fund.
I read that it was some crazy figure that we give, like 85
billion over the last decade.
85 billion over what period?
It's about, I think, since 2012. So over about 11, 12 years.
It's just absurd, isn't it? So what is the situation there, actually? Are we kind of obligated to give them money?
No. No, and one of the frustrating things about our attitude towards the global quangocracy, these organisations, is we tend to actually be far more generous funders relative to our GDP than other countries. So our GDP per capita, I think our GDP comes to something somewhere around 6 or 7 in the world.
Yeah.
But actually, for a lot of these organisations, we're their third or fourth biggest funder. And yet you see organisations like the International Monetary Fund warn the Chancellor in the lead up to the budget that he cannot cut taxes.
Yeah.
This is completely wrong. Yeah. This is absolutely outrageous that this organization, this vast behemoth of an organization, that, let's be honest, you go out onto the street and ask the average person, have they even heard of the International Monetary Fund?
Yes.
Let alone what does it do? How is it funded? Who are its staff? Who's the director? Nobody's going to know this. And yet this organization with, you know, difficult to imagine their sway, right? But this was a warning that was written up in most of the papers, that made the front pages of some of the papers. And of course, will have made Downing Street, the Chancellor, nervous, because this is an organisation with huge sway. But it's an organisation funded by British taxpayers, and yet it's telling the government what it should and shouldn't be doing in terms of domestic sovereign fiscal policy. It's really, really disturbing.
We should just simply stop, is that right?
It's difficult to say stop because, again, most of these organisations in their past have done some good work. The WHO, particularly in its early decades in terms of its work on things like polio, a lot of these organisations have done good work.
Yeah.
But like, you know, there's that old saying that unless an organisation is specifically set up to be conservative or right wing, it will always end up being taken over by the left.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think that's what we're starting to see. We're seeing these global quangos be taken over by the exact sort of people that want to go after Robert Louis Stevenson.
Yes.
And the issue we have with the UK government and this Conservative government, let's be blunt, is that they're not using the influence they have, the fact that they are one of the biggest funders, despite the fact we're not the biggest economy.
Yeah.
We're not using that influence to say, that's outrageous. Yeah. You are not to interfere in domestic sovereign politics. You're not to interfere on something as fundamental to sovereignty and the sovereign power of an elected government as what the tax level is, what income tax level is.
So why don't we though? Why are we not saying that?
I think the current Conservative government, one of its biggest faults and one of the biggest themes has been an unwillingness to ever push back.
Yeah.
To always go along with the flow.
Yeah.
To talk about the Stonewall issue, to talk about the trans one, you mentioned that you feel that it's peaked and it does look like it has, but it's taken a long time to get there. You know, we had surgeries and treatments and hormones and all the rest of it for essentially children for years under a Conservative government, until eventually the pushback became so strong that the Conservative government finally recognized it was actually going against the tide of not even public opinion necessarily, but the opinion of a certain narrow, let's call it the Westminster bubble. And I think the biggest theme of this Conservative government is whatever they say and whatever they even may believe privately, they've always been so reluctant to ever actually push back against dangerous, unsettling themes. And this is just one of them.
This particular government and these particular Tories, I'd say, are particularly bad. I don't quite remember it being quite so bad as this. I mean, along the same lines, during the whole BLM thing that happened, in 2020? And then after that, there was this whole kind of cultural revolution going on in our institutions. And the British Library, I remember this very clearly, they wanted to decolonize their collection.
Yes.
British Library,
yeah,
you know, which is like the absolutely central to our culture. And they get about 90 million.
That sounds about right. I mean, it would be a lot of money, yeah. Yeah. Sounds, I don't know.
And that would come direct from the government, via the Arts Council or direct from government. I'm not sure, because, you know, there are two ways, aren't there? And frankly, you know, people say, as conservatives or someone of conservative mind, you know, that somehow you should treasure these things. But increasingly, you know, I sort of feel, well, actually, wait a minute, you know, you're not doing what you're meant to. In fact, this heritage is actually not really safe in your hands, actually. That you should not, I should not be paying for it.
Yeah, I think that was, I mean, listen, there's so many examples. I mean, there's examples right up and down the country of this. There's a museum in York that started attaching testimonies of various groups to pictures. So there was one of St. Agatha, whose breasts were cut off. She was a Christian martyr, and her breasts were cut off. And there was a text from a trans person that said that seeing someone represented in historical religious art with their breasts removed was very empowering. This is someone that died as a religious martyr, and as part of her torture had this happen to her. And this is a museum in York, one of, again, absolutely central to our culture, York, sort of the great medieval city, the iconic medieval city. And yet one of its museums, again, funded by taxpayers, is engaging in the sort of cultural relativism that I think horrifies the average person on the street. But, you know, frankly, listen, the average person on the street has so many things to worry about: how to pay the bills, how to pay the mortgage, kids, everything in life, that it's difficult for them to, on a day-to-day basis, push back against it.
Yes, exactly. That is always the case. And also to have increasingly the courage to do it, you know, because, you know, the consequences can be dire for people, I mean, particularly if you are working. You know, but I think that's got to change. People have got to kind of get more courageous, I think. But one area that's very close to the hearts of our viewers is the BBC.
Yes.
And can't possibly go without talking a bit about the BBC. You actually had a campaign some while ago, didn't you? I think it was called Axe the Tax. So you want the license fee gone?
Yes. Listen, there are parts of the BBC that, and maybe I'm out of touch here, maybe I'm behind the times. There are parts of the BBC I do think are worth preserving, and that without taxpayer funding probably would struggle. For my sins, I still enjoy the proms. I know it's not what it was decades ago, but I still enjoy the proms. Yeah. And I think there are certain things, I think you look at Radio 3, you look at the World Service, maybe Radio 4, that are possibly worth preserving. Right. And actually, if you switch to a subscription fee model, maybe you would lose it.
Right.
And I think there are some cultural elements that possibly do need taxpayer support. People often talk about the opera and the ballet as good examples. But for the rest of it, for most of the BBC, ultimately you could put it in a subscription model exactly like Netflix and Amazon, and people choose what they want to pay for and what they don't want to pay for. When the BBC was founded, because of the way that broadcasting worked, BBC was the only thing you could get on your TV. It was the only thing. You could only ever have one channel, and you couldn't stop people from getting it. If people plug themselves into the network, they wouldn't get the BBC. So in that case, a license fee is appropriate, because if you own a TV, by definition, you get the BBC, and therefore you should pay for that product. Yeah. That's not the case now. You can scramble anything. You can restrict the BBC to just people that pay and just people that pay a subscription. And you always hear people talk about how wonderful the BBC is and how much content they create, how much variety. Well, if it is that wonderful, people will pay.
Yes.
People pay for Netflix. People often, I think I have, I don't know about you, but I have 5 or 6 of these subscription
programs
on the go. I mean, I can't remember which ones, to be honest. I saw them on the track.
Yes,
it's worth it.
Yes. I mean, I stopped paying the license fee. I got rid of my TV almost about 3 years ago now. I'm with you. I mean, look, I'm a, you know, my generation, creature of the BBC, all of that, the arts programs and the proms and things. Not just that, but the kind of big national events.
Of course, of course.
But fact is, it just, you know, you can't keep sort of like arguing for something that once existed.
Yes.
I just don't think it exists anymore. And, you know, you think, actually, it's interesting. You sort of think, well, you would pretty much disapprove of me, the BBC, you know, as a kind of Brexiteer person, generally conservative. Why should I give you my money? I mean, particularly, why should I give you, you know, for what amounts to kind of propaganda? I'm thinking in terms of the drama and the comedy and all of these things. You know? I mean, but so I've pardoned. I've come right round to actually say, just get rid of the license fee.
Yeah.
You know, but none of this, you know, I think at one point people were saying you should have a much reduced one of about 50 quid or something. I think get rid of, because it does work, doesn't it? People do buy subscriptions.
Yes.
They, you know, whether it's Amazon Prime or whether it's Netflix.
And they pay good money for it. Yeah. I think the key thing is there cannot be any compulsion in it. Yeah. That's how a subscription service works.
Yeah.
And maybe there are a few parts of the BBC that you at least try directly funding from the Treasury rather than linking it to owning a TV or whatever technology it is. And I think that's worth a try because I think you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Yeah. And I think your concern is that there isn't a baby left. And I think that is a real one.
Mm.
But I, you know, the TPA's view is to at least give it a try and take the bulk of it and say, if people want to pay, they can pay.
Yeah.
And for the remaining bits, look at directly funding it out the Treasury, and that's worth a try. But I think ultimately the license fee is basically a model that says, if you have a TV, no matter whether or not you use the BBC, not only that, no matter whether you approve of the BBC, you may find it directly antithetical to your values, you still have to pay. And if you don't pay, and this is only a small minority of cases, but it does happen, you could actually go to jail.
Yes.
And the really disturbing thing is most of the people going to jail are old women.
That's right. In fact,
it's really disturbing.
I think it's the second biggest reason for women to be in the criminal justice system. And this is another thing, is it not, where the Tories sort of faded away. They were going to decriminalise it, weren't they? They were going to decriminalise non-payment of the licence fee. It was going to become a civil thing, a bit like not paying a traffic fine or something.
Yeah, I don't know what the status of that is. I don't think it's happened yet.
Oh, no, it hasn't.
No. And again, that would be an obvious...
Yes,
exactly. That would be an obvious way to deal with the absolute worst excesses of this problem.
Yes.
It would be a baby step. But again, the problem with this government is it's so often they don't even take the baby steps.
Well, Elliot, thank you so much for telling us about this. Where can people find your research on your website? Is that the best place to download?
So taxpayersalliance.com. If you're interested in, we have a weekly email that goes out on Sunday. Yeah. That's kind of the best bits of our week. That's taxpayersalliance.com/join. It's, you know, we don't make the email too long. We're aware that people's, you know, have got better things to do on a Sunday, but it is a good and interesting email, and it does contain our best bits. So I would point them to that.
And that's right up to date. So we've got Robert Louis Stevenson on there and everything.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Which I know is the thing.
If you can just stay with us, because we have just a couple of questions for you for our members. But
yeah, of course.
In the meantime, thank you so much for joining. Thank you. That was great, Elliot there from the Taxpayers Alliance. Please don't forget about Manchester, will you, on Tuesday. Just drop us a line if you want to come. But in the meantime, have a good week, and we shall see you next week. Thank you. Bye.